One of the things that struck me most, especially when it comes to art and design, is the actual craft work and the authenticity in that, in terms of making something from the artist's hand and it being a direct product of their actions. And going back to the idea of like sewing and knitting and doing everything by hand, which was traditionally very much a woman's work and a domestic work. And so that has also been really interesting, looking into that, because it's taking away the mass production high-end glamour of it and going right back to basics.
Hello everyone. So today I am with Sophie. Hello Sophie.
Hi.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for accepting my invitation.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's lovely to be able to talk about all these things that I love.
Yes.
It's been so lonely in lockdown.
Yes, that's true. In the UK and I'm in France, but hopefully, thanks to technology, we're able to speak together virtually.
Yeah. I know, thanks to technology.
As you know, the main subject of the podcast is the notion of modesty, and that's why I contacted you, and I think you were interested in that subject. Yeah. So what would be your definition of modesty in fashion, art, and luxury?
I mean, so many things came to mind when I first started thinking about modesty, especially, I mean, within fashion, it's like I started to think about the idea of covering up and modesty in that sense, I guess quite an old-fashioned sense, and having things really pared down and not being avant-garde or grand. But with art, I see it in a very different way, which is to be very honest and, you know, opening up your flaws and being incredibly vulnerable in front of a large audience and expressing what it is that makes you, expressing your failures, I think, and expressing the darker sides of you, because obviously with art you can make it anything you want, and a lot of the time we want to just show our very best selves, and there's artists out there who will aim to do the opposite and make it very powerful. So, but there's so many different interpretations, and I've sort of found, looking through different fashion brands and different artists, that there's different interpretations that kind of bring out different things. So I'm really excited to talk about it.
And, you know, I think the most important thing maybe would be showing a form of authenticity.
I think absolutely. I think one of the things that struck me most, especially when it comes to art and design, is the actual craft work and the authenticity in that, in terms of making something from the artist's hand and it being a direct product of their actions, and going back to the idea of like sewing and knitting and doing everything by hand, which was traditionally very much a woman's work and a domestic work. And so that has also been really interesting, looking into that, because it's taking away the mass production high-end glamour of it and going right back to basics.
And you know, I also think that sometimes the imperfection of things makes all the beauty of it, because when it's too when something is too perfect, sometimes it looks fake, you know.
Yeah, it does. And I think people always want a one-off, don't they? I mean, there's nothing worse than turning up to a party and someone's wearing the same dress as you. And I think when people seek out vintage pieces or one-off design pieces, it's, you love it because of that, like, maybe there's like a bit of shabbiness to it. There's a wornness to it. There's something that makes it very unique. And I think it's amazing now seeing designers going out and using that as their inspiration to make every single piece that they make unique. So.
That's it. And you know, I forgot to ask you, could you introduce yourself, please? Because we just started right into the subject, but I'm so sorry, it's my fault.
Well,
so please, as I always ask, could you introduce yourself in like two sentences?
Sure. So my name is Sophia Shepherd, and I am a art curator and writer from London. And I've been working in the arts for just around 8 to 9 years, maybe a bit less actually, 7 years. I'm trying to work out when I graduated, but yeah.
Okay. And if we talk about your studies, what did you study?
So I studied at Goldsmiths, which is a, it was originally an art college in Southeast London. And it had the likes of Damien Hirst and the filmmaker Steve McQueen and Lucian Freud all practiced there. So it's got quite a cool artist alumni. And I studied history of art there. So that was in 2011 to 2014, which I loved and I completely fell in love with it. And I specialised in contemporary art. And then roughly 3 years later, I went and did my master's degree in history of art again, just because I love it so much.
Please, why do you love art so much? Why did you want to study art and not, I don't know, physics or I don't know?
I think it was just because of the, I picked it as a random subject at A level, which is the qualification we do between the ages of 16 to 18 before you go on to university. And it was a really last minute decision to pick. I think I was doing photography and English literature, and it seemed like a in-between point. And then just from studying quite the basics of art history, like learning about history, learning about society, learning about culture through art, and with, instead of the history textbooks with artists, they're just showing it, they're showing the stories that were happening around them in any form that they want, with any expression they want. They're not restricted by that. And I think it was exciting because you're seeing so many different extremes of opinion all expressed through art. And I think one of the things that I specialised at university was in philosophy, so the philosophy of art. And that just brings you onto a whole new dimension. It's such an abstract theme. You think about like the idea of existence and time and material and matter, all of these things which all come from art. And art is such a broad term. I mean, it's theatre, it's song, it's clothing, it's fabric design, whatever. It's so broad and it tells so much. Every piece can tell such a big story about when and where and the setting that it was made in. So that was for me the something that I found really fascinating.
And what was the things that you learned that really, I don't know, left you speechless or just like made you see the world in a whole new way?
I think it was learning about the movement into abstract, and it sort of started with the Impressionism in the 1800s, where artists started to rebel against trying to make a subject matter look completely realistic and lifelike and perfect, and made their work more and more about just painting itself, matter itself. And if you sort of look at the 1800s to the 1900s, you can see a real change and shift in waves. It's almost like the paintings are getting shallower and shallower and shallower, and the paint is getting towards the front of the canvas more and more. And then you get to abstract expressionism, and it's the painting itself, the subject matter is about painting. It is about the thick impasto brushstrokes on the canvas. And it just makes you think about how it's almost like a mind, it plays with your head so much because you're constantly thinking about material and matter and that being the subject itself, even though art was so traditionally used to depict things, to depict scenes, to depict, you know, battles or you know, historical events. And then these were, it takes it away and it makes it into art itself, and that it's like a really strange concept to deal with.
And what does abstract art represent? It depicts an idea. What's in the mind of the artist? How would you read an abstract painting?
It's purely about the form and color and itself. That it's in a way quite simple, but there's a lot of deep theological writing about it, which even I can't really grapple with. But when it comes to abstract art, I mean, so for example, a Distill painting by Mondrian, so the very rectilinear forms and clean cut colours, it was about the science of it. It was about the balance and looking at shape and looking at line and how they come together and how they complement each other together. And it's a story between shapes and forms, not between people. And that was really, and that's it. You know, that is what you're looking at. And it's the same with a big abstract expressionist painting, for example, by Jackson Pollock. His painting is about the way that the paint drips onto the canvas and the different heights it comes from and how it reacts to the blot of paint that was already there when it falls on top of it. That is what the painting's about. And that's what's quite exciting, because it is just purely aesthetic. And I think, of course, each individual artist will be, at the time that they're painting, it will be about something personal to them. But it comes out in this expression, and this expression is just a pure product on its own, away from their intention to make it about a certain narrative.
And do you think there's modesty in abstract art?
I guess so, because I think it's drawing back art to just pure form. And in a way, when we look at modesty in a way of keeping it, stripping back illusion and stripping back disguise, there's no free dimensionality in it. There's no sort of aspect of illusion. It's just pure form, and I think it's not therefore misleading you. So when you look into a Renaissance painting or a beautiful like Baroque or a genre painting, it's so perfect and specific. It's like you're actually looking into the real scene itself. Mm. With abstract art, they're not trying to make an illusion of anything. What they show you is what the art is. And so I think in a way, yeah, there is modesty there, because it's just stripping everything back and talking about the materials itself. And they're not trying to win you over with an illusion. It's quite...
Yes, because abstract art is just like forms and shapes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm. And that's it. Like, that is the simple message of it. But that's how I see it anyway.
And you studied art, but are you yourself an artist? Like, do you paint?
Never professionally, no. I do really enjoy drawing, and I have like a film camera, which I love taking photos on. So in that aspect, that is what I do just in my spare time. Mm. Never good enough to actually become an artist. Yeah, I mean, studying art at school and drawing and painting was what led me into art history. So I've always enjoyed doing it.
But you said that you were also a writer, and you studied writing at the university as well?
It was just part of my course. So throughout the course, we were encouraged to write reviews, go to art galleries and art exhibitions and write and reflect on our experiences. And then coming out of university, I've just done more and more articles for sort of small independent magazines and zines. I like writing about art history in comparison with today's culture. So, for example, looking at a real cultural wave that is very mainstream. So, for example, the Victoria's Secret fashion show, you know, when they dress up as angels, and then comparing that to how cupids were depicted in like early Baroque paintings, and seeing like the similarities. So I really love the idea of like looking at society today and looking at our culture today, and then how we've seen it before in art and how it's influenced us. So
that's really interesting. And you know, there's something we say in fashion, that fashion is just a constant renewal, that all it's a cycle that renews itself. And would you say the same for art?
I guess so, because I think it's really hard to know how you would define the genre of art in 2021. So we had, like, for example, the 1800s, it was like we began with the Impressionism, and there was a bit more of rebellion coming about. And then in the 1900s, that was at its height, and we had conceptual art. So we had Duchamp making the urinal. And now I feel like we're slipping back into, people are starting to grapple with life drawings and nudes and making things really lifelike, and going. And also there's a huge wave of craft work and tapestry making and textile making, which is one of the oldest forms of craft. And there's been so many young artists graduating in the last couple of years who are using that style. I think there is a renewal, there's a renewal, but when there is, it's saying something a little bit different. And it's always echoing back to where the last time it was in that cycle was, if that makes sense.
And you know, that makes me think about something. I'd like to have your opinion on that. I think you knew what happened at Art Basel, where a banana became so famous and was sold at an incredible price. What did you think about that? Like, could a banana be a piece of art?
I don't know about that, actually. I'm scared, so ashamed to say. Tell me a bit more about that.
I think it was last year at Art Basel at Miami, a banana was sold at a very incredible price, and people were like, but how come someone would buy a banana at maybe $1 million, you know? And yeah. It made me feel like sometimes, maybe just because of the context that it was at Art Basel, people thought that everything they saw was art. So they saw a banana and they were like, maybe it's art.
Oh, not right. Okay. Yes. This is all coming back to me.
you remember? I'm not crazy.
No, you're not crazy at all. It was just more that my brain froze for a moment. Yes, I know. Well, I mean, this is a different... I approach the art industry from a very art historical place, whereas some of my colleagues and who I've worked for before have approached it from a very art business place. So they look at like the value of art and how it goes up and why it goes up. And they're amazing minds with looking at like print editions and why they have so much value. And from my perspective, there is an art in itself with art dealers and how they create value to something, and they build hype around something. And it's like anything really, like in a way where we can look at a painting and it's canvas and paint and matter on a paint, and that's all it is. But the fact that a guy called Jackson Pollock, who was really famous, painted it makes it worth millions. And I think really with an object like a banana, it's almost like if you can apply a meaning or a speciality to something, then of course people who have that amount of money will pay for it. I think it's but it's totally mind-boggling, and it's not really something I know a huge amount as to why do we pay like £10,000 for a print edition of an artist. Like, all of these things, it's a print, usually they should cost like a tenner, £10, but people will pay such a huge amount for a piece of work, and sometimes they don't even put it up in their house, they put it in storage. And it's a really different, it depends how you're coming at art and what you want to gain from it. And sometimes that is about value, which is fair enough.
Yes, and value, it's a subjective thing. So it's all about the context and the perception you give to it and the interest you have toward the art you are being.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And if we, because now we kind of took another road, but we were talking about your studies and when you graduated, how did you find your first job? What did you do after graduating from university?
Well, my first job was utterly random. I did a lot of unpaid internships for art galleries and then a lot for like film production companies, because it was just what I could get. And I was anything that I was interested in. So art, film, fashion, I was just applying to different places.
And did you learn a lot in these internships? What did you learn?
To be honest, a lot of it is just about work ethic and working hard and having a good stamina. And you learn a lot of people skills because you're the bottom of the sort of hierarchy in a company and how you have to communicate with people. It was more about that than it was about learning about film or art, to be honest. It was more about, because you might come and, you know, VIP famous guests will come in and how you interact with them and how you conduct yourself and how you negotiate situations, how you deal with really difficult situations where people can be demanding of you or people can treat you badly. And it's like how you sort of navigate that. That was the main thing that I learned from my internships, really, because a lot of the time you're not really interacting with what you thought you would be, which would be like, you know, talking about film, but really actually you're running all across London trying to post office or whatever.
So after that you did find a job?
Yeah, so I ended up sort of by mistake, or just sort of fell into it, was working for TV and film media. So I got my first actual proper job as a runner on a film, which we filmed out in Ibiza, and it was the most mad, like, dive into deep water experience ever. And then I just sort of ended up working for like various different like TV shows. So, and I was all the time thinking, I want to get into art somehow. How do I get into the arts? How do I do this? And it just came to the point where it just wasn't going the way I wanted it to. So I took a break and I went and moved to Paris for a year and did my master's degree there, to reconnect, really, because I sort of lost sight of what I loved so much about studying art history.
And that's interesting. Please tell us more about your experience in Paris. Was it the first time?
I'd been before as a tourist when I was very young. You know, when you're like dragged around by your family in the rain, just trying to like hit every tourist spot. It was never normally the like whole experience of a city. So I was really excited to go to Paris and experience it as a Parisian. I mean, obviously I wasn't a Parisian, but I could pretend to be for a year. And it was, do you know what? I was really scared about it.
Right.
Yeah, because I didn't know the language, and I had to learn from scratch when I was there. And I was nervous about how people would retrieve me, you know, this kind of, I could really understand if they'd be impatient with me trying to order food. And I just found the Parisian people to be the most lovely, welcoming, encouraging people, like so encouraging with the language, so patient, so sweet. And I even had quite close relationships with Parisians there. So I nannied for a family I nannied for this 3-year-old and I got to know her really well, obviously, but then also her mother, and she would help me with my French and she was also trying to improve her English. And I just sort of found, I got so much generosity from the people there, and I'm still in contact with them today. So I think it was definitely for me that struck me the most about Paris was the people.
That's interesting, you know, because people say that Parisians complain all the time. They are never happy.
I know. That's what I was expecting. I didn't want to say it, but I was sort of like, I fell for this horrible stereotype that's about Parisians. But really, I just had the complete different experience. Maybe it's just me, but I utterly loved them. I really did.
But that's again, cool. And where did you study?
So it was actually a British university, the University of Kent, but they have campuses around Europe and they had one in Paris. So it was, I mean, a brilliant program, really amazing, but in a way it does hinder your French speaking because you're learning in English and also all of your other classmates are English speaking. So yeah, I didn't get to advance my French as much as I would like.
So you had an English education even though you were in Paris.
But we got French lessons and we could, there were so many programs set up around the city for foreigners coming to, not for, what's the word, sorry, I'm trying to think of it, so like expats coming to the city and wanting to learn the language. There was a lot of hospital, like there was, sorry, I'm not getting my words right, there was just a lot of programs set up helping people to learn French, wherever it be, like almost like speed dating sessions where you'd speak 7 minutes of French to one person and they move on to the next and you speak 7 minutes of French to the next person, things like that.
And you know, I had a question, like, do you think that Paris is as creative as London?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think there's so many parallels when you're just looking at the street art to looking at the performers in the street to looking at the contemporary galleries to looking at the big established institutes, so the Musée d'Orsay in comparison to the National Gallery in London. I didn't really, to be honest, it might just be my own ignorance of what's happening in London, but I felt like there was more writing and speaking events going on in Paris in terms of writing workshops and spoken word nights. I felt like there was more of that happening in Paris. Paris to me felt a little bit more impromptu. So, you know, a group of people coming together and if they wanted to perform a poem in the cafe, they could. I think there was almost more of that happening, whereas in London it's a little, it has to be a little bit more like planned ahead and structured. So for Paris it felt a little bit more spontaneous.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
Again, this is just my experience, so you know, I don't want to, yeah, Londoners will be listening being like, what, I'm always at spoken word events. But that's just my, you know, perspective of it, my view of
but
it.
You know, I've been to London, and when I went to London I had the feeling that London in general was more creative than Paris, and even people, you know, people say that Parisians always wear black. But I think the style of people and the city and the behavior of people in general in London was very more outgoing, you know?
Did you mean it just so like the individuals, like almost when you're walking around the street, you would see a difference in, yeah, like someone's individual style or the way they carry themselves?
Yes, and even the ambience, you know, I think it's Piccadilly Circus. People were always smiling and like ready to help you. I don't know, maybe it's because I've never lived in London. I was just there for holidays, but had the feeling that there were more creativity in the air in London than there is in Paris.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I've lived in London longer, so there's always things, there's a lot of small independent things happening. So like small art exhibitions happen. I mean, obviously this is all when we're not in the middle of a pandemic, but yeah, there's always small workshops going on or pop-up cafes, pop-up boutique shops, things like that. I think definitely from my peer group, there's a lot of people who want to start an idea and start something, an experimental creative project, which is really exciting. So, but it's also, I'm a bit like you with Paris. I'm really happy to know that people
we always find the grass greener on the other side.
I know, but I feel like I was just like, I feel really happy if someone says, oh yeah, I went to London, people were really nice. I'm like, oh my God, because I feel like we've also got a bit of a reputation for being rude and cold.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I hope we're not.
And so you stay 1 year in Paris studying, and after you came back to London?
Yeah, and then I did a lot more writing for just on a freelance base. And then I was just really determined that I wanted to have a job working with contemporary art directly. And after sort of a very long job search, I found a job as a curator for a art consultancy in London, and I was there for nearly 2 years. So yeah.
And what did you do exactly?
So the art consultancy itself specialized in bringing art collections to workplaces, or we worked a lot with interior designers. So they would come to us with this hotel that they're creating and they wanted artwork in it. And so it was our job to think of the artwork that could go into it and then make it happen, basically. My job as the curator was to just do the research. So research a theme, a concept, like what's going to tie in with this place aesthetically, what's going to complement the story of the building or the location or the company that it's going to be within. And then we would do a visual storyboard. So we would create basically communicating how this idea is evolving and then what final artworks we wanted to put forward. And then it would be a real working process with our clients. So a lot of back and forth about ideas and what's going to work, what's not going to work. And there's there's always, you know, things like budgets, logistics, restrictions on space, time, all of these things come into it. So we start with this like very ambitious collection, and then sometimes you have to alter it a little bit to get it in within what's achievable. And I think one of my favourite parts of the job was communicating with the artists. We had a roster of artists, usually quite young, graduating to mid-level career artists, who we would sign to our catalogue and curate those relationships with them and encourage their work practice. And I think I actually came away with quite a lot of friends from it, just from following their art careers, which has been super lovely.
So that's good, because you were working with like young artists, like not very well-known artists. So also supporting the emerging artists.
Yes. Yeah, emerging. And I think especially within the last year, with everything that's happened with COVID-19, I felt really passionate about bringing the light the artists that graduated in 2020, but it also might now happen again in 2021, because usually there's it must be in Paris as well, but in London in the summer, when it'll be like fashion graduates and art graduates, they put on big exhibitions and big shows that you can go and see. And you know, in the summer of 2019, I was going to like 2-3 a week and meeting loads of artists and getting to see what art they're doing. But of course, when coronavirus hits and we're on a lockdown, there's nothing like that at all. And so many of these graduates really rely on that exhibition, because that's where a lot of art dealers and a lot of curators and a lot of writers will come to it. So they didn't get the same exposure that they could have done. And that's sort of how I got involved in just trying to help promote their work on my own Instagram and on other platforms as well. And now I'm just, have almost only been consuming graduate art. I'm like, that's sort of the main people that I am following and looking at the moment. I mean, I think you go through such phases of what art you're looking at the time. But yeah, definitely graduate art is like, has been my main focal point.
Yes, I guess that now it's very complicated time for young artists with all the lockdown and stuff like that.
Massively, because they just, I mean, even with fashion graduates, so you'd usually have a catwalk show and would have employers come to it to talent scout, and they just don't. So, yes. I mean, they have online platforms, obviously, which has been great, and I think it has been effective and helpful. But it's just not the same, is it?
Yes, it's not the same at all. Because when you see the clothes, you know, when sometimes you can touch it, it's not the same experience.
And seeing people, seeing it in real life, you know, when a model walks past the flow of the dress.
Let's hope things will get back to normal soon. So after your experience, what did you do? It's maybe what you are doing right now. You are freelancing or you have new projects?
Yeah, I'm working on, it's sort of in that weird stage where you're working on lots of little things that are going on in the background, but none of which are coming to light yet. But I am working on a project which will be, I'm collaborating with a magazine about young emerging artists and doing sort of a digital platform with them. I'm doing some writing. A lot of that actually is surrounding around graduate artists, and I definitely want to bring a focus to the ones graduating this summer. And yeah, I sort of just have been doing little bits of curation here and there, but I definitely want to jump back onto it full time soon. But it is quite nice because there's been so many things boiling in a while that you just don't have the time to spend because you're working a full-time job. And, you know, in a lot of creative jobs as well, the hours are demanding, the time is demanding. It's a lot of energy from you, and you just don't then have that brain capacity to then work on your other projects. So it has been nice to focus on.
Yes, unfortunately, they only have 24 hours.
Yes, I know. I need to sleep. Sometimes 24 hours, you need to sleep. So you lose a lot of time.
But that's good. So we know that you are working on a lot of projects. And if we come to the next part related to your inspirations, who would be the three designers or brand that maybe incarnate your vision of modesty in fashion?
Oh, I had so much fun just looking at designers, or the designers that I want to talk about. So firstly, it's a British label called Shrimps. So Shrimps was launched by Hannah Wieland in 2013. So it's fairly young. And it is such a quintessentially English rose of a brand. It's beautiful frill frocks, it's pearls, pinks, soft pastel colours. And the way I feel like it incarnates modesty is because it brings it back to this almost 18th century. And it is, and the aesthetic itself is heavily inspired by Jane Austen novels, so those period dramas with like long covering materials, and it's very modest in the very sort of a female modesty.
I'm seeing the Instagram page while you're talking. It's very elegant and graceful. I didn't know this brand.
Yeah. Oh, they are. It's just so beautiful, and especially if you look at their accessories, the pearl bags, which are actually handmade. So again, it's bringing it back to like the act of craft. And I think they kind of are looking at displaying prettiness whilst hiding sexuality. But of course, in this modern day, that can be interpreted in so many ways. So there is a slight ounce of rebellion within Shrimps, the way it might just be their marketing campaigns. But it kind of reminds me of sort of the covering of the body
And you know, the name is very intriguing because you told me shrimps. I was like, is she talking about seafood?
Have you seen, well, the logo is two shrimps. Yes.
And what's the relationship between the name and the brand?
I feel it would be interesting
to know. Maybe there's a link between the brand and the name itself.
Shrimps. I'm going to have to look it up now. I wonder if it's... I think it was a... I know that they're cruelty-free, so all their clothing, none of the materials come from animals, which could be a... I think it's kind of meant to be quite quirky and humorous. And the word shrimps is unusual. When you take away the context and meaning of it, it's like, you know, the way it's written and the way it looks.
And that's maybe what adds even more beauty to the brand, the contrast between the name in itself and the image of the brand.
Well, I think it is meant to be quite a juxtaposition. You've kind of got quite a uniformed, modest, refrained appearance, but then there's this kind of sudden jolt of rebellion. So there's like a mad pattern on a fur coat or a pea collar that's just so ever so slightly oversized that it looks a bit avant-garde. And I think, yeah, there's a bit of juxtaposition happening within the design of the clothes.
Well, that's a very good discovery. Thank you. And who will be your next one?
So my next one is a very young, new to the fashion industry. It's Amy Gosher. So she's a knitwear designer and she graduated last year in fashion design. And all her works are hand sewn. So, and she is just, I interviewed her for a magazine and her work is, it's all about sustainable practice. So it's all about using materials and making pieces that can be worn again and again and again and will be long lasting. So slow fashion. And I think it's modest because it's bringing this idea of taking an idea of craft work, women's work, knitting, things like that, that wasn't highly regarded as a great talent or creativity back in the day. It was sort of seen as like every woman of the house should be able to do it. And of course, it's an incredible skill and it's an incredible talent. And I think with Amy's work, she flies with that idea. And it's like what we were talking about before about loving flaws in our clothing. Her knitwear is purposely a little bit disjointed, so some of the threads are left dangling, and it's all just a bit rustic. And it is just quite a raw, earthy feel about it. And it doesn't have any airs or graces. It's just really beautiful and authentic. And I think, so she's developing her collection and her brand at the moment, but I can't wait what she's gonna do next. It's very exciting.
Yes, it's very also beautiful. I'm on her page and I really like what she does.
Yeah,
she's inspired also by nature, flowers.
I think it's like bringing it back to earth, quite literally, as in terms of what we find on our earth and in our natural surroundings.
That's interesting. Another beautiful discovery. You know, I'm always glad when people tell me new brands that I didn't know, because it's always good to discover new artists and new designers.
I mean, some of my favorite conversations ever is just swapping recommendations for, you know, artists, designers, books, whatever. Like sometimes my favorite way to just spend a day is chatting with a friend.
would you have a next beautiful discovery related to modesty?
Yeah, so it's actually a French brand, Orne, but it's based in the UK, so I'm not entirely sure of its origins, but the designer takes secondhand archive pieces, so almost like photographic images of patterns from clothing collections that were in the 80s or 90s, and prints it onto the pattern of their dresses and their pieces. So the overall style and tailoring of the clothing is quite 90s. So those, you know, quite like figure hugging, draped dresses that are feel very elegant and graceful, but they have this design imprinted over them. And it's almost by referencing fashion houses from the 80s and 90s, it's kind of very much exposing its own reference and its own inspiration. So it's not taking the ideas as their own and running with it and showing off about it. It's being very modest in terms of saying, actually, everything that I know now is because of a past designer. So,
and what's the name of the designer?
It's Aune, A-U-N-E.
Okay.
It's E with an accent.
Oh, yes, I see. Oh, that's interesting also. I didn't know. Well, thank you very much. I put the link of the designers in the description so that...
Yeah, I can send you some.
Yes, if you have the information, I can add it to the description. And now if you talk about art, I'm sure you have a lot of beautiful inspiration related to this.
Yeah, I mean, what I mentioned before about the tapestry artists, so a lot of graduate shows in 2019 and 2020, actually, there was some really, it was taking it back to textile art and using things like looking at like needlework and embroidery, and some really fantastic artists that came out of it. One of them was, I think she even graduated 2020, was Anya Pansil. So she's a Welsh Ghanaian artist who was actually, her work was exhibited at the 154 Art Fair in London, which is an art fair for African artists that, Sorry, can I say that again?
Yes.
I'll start from the top. So Anya Pansil is a Welsh Ghanaian artist, and she is, I think she was graduated in 2020, but she's a tapestry artist. And I saw her work exhibited at the 154 Art Fair, which is an art fair exhibiting contemporary African artists. And she uses methods that involve rug hooking, embroidery. She also incorporates the Afro hairdressing, and she wants the works to be really tactile. So she wants you to be able to touch them. You know, they're in the form of rugs and tapestry, so and even the froze. So you should be able to almost play with them and experience them on like a physical level as well. But they're also quite politically charged. So it's kind of talking about this idea of a domestic setting, something that feels like home and feels quite comforting, but the work and the subject matters are quite political and completely unapologetic. And so it's that balance that's happening. But I feel like she's able to allow the politicalness to come through with the medium and the materials that she uses. It makes it more accessible. It makes it more direct to the viewer itself. So yeah, she's a really exciting artist. And there's actually one, an artist similar who I know very well called Selby Hurst Inglefield. So her work is also about rug hooking and embroidery, but she tells scenes of memories from her childhood. And she says that she wants her work to feel like something you would have in your home. So she wants her work to remind you of home. And it's kind of, I love the idea of it because it's so modest in the way that it says that they're not trying to have an artwork that you would display, you know, in a public realm somewhere as a big triumph. They want something for someone's, you know, cove and their habitat and where they spend their private moments. They want their art to be a space there, which I think is a really, like, beautiful sentiment with it.
Yes, it's a good approach. And how did you discover this artist?
So Anya, I discovered at 154, which is, if anyone's ever in London when 154 is on, it's honestly the best contemporary art fair there is. And then Selby, she was a graduate of Central St. Martin's, an art school in London, and I found her at the 2019 grad show. And yeah, basically just wanted to make her a contact immediately because I loved her work.
And it's sort of, it's also related to modesty, so that's a very good way to, to see her work.
Yeah, she's, I think, I love artists who have seemingly simple agendas with their art. So it feels like they're not trying to be hugely ambitious with what they want to do. They have a very genuine and sincere message with their art. I think those are my favorites.
And you know, sometimes I think that it's maybe counterintuitive, but the biggest ambition is to achieve art with simplicity, because sometimes simplicity is very complex to achieve, I think.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's why I feel like they're the most talented artists, and it's almost something that it has to be talent, it has to be natural, because, like, exactly what you said, you know, simplicity is really difficult to achieve.
And would you have another one to share?
Yes, I've got a few more.
Oh, go ahead. So we have time. We are in lockdown.
One of them is actually a friend of mine, Emma Algaretti. So Emma also was at Goldsmiths at the same time as me, but we met working on a burger stall for a pop-up cinema and cafe in London. I think it was in the year we both graduated. But she is an illustrator who very much has found her platform and growth of her career on Instagram. And I think she is really within this realm of female illustrators that just purely want to connect with other women. And I think there's other really famous illustrators such as Alice Skinner and Polly Knorr. And what theirs and Emma's work does is it uses vulnerability and honesty as a superpower. So her illustrations are always so funny, but so relatable. So she shows female figures in their times of rawness. And this could be showing someone at the time of rock bottom or their failures, or, you know, sitting in bed crying, smoking and eating McDonald's. It's kind of this, like, we all try and show the best versions of ourselves on our social media platforms and show us looking glamorous and achieving and doing well, when a lot of the time, a lot of us are, you know, moping around at home. And she captures that, but it's really beautiful at the same time. She manages to make beauty and strength in a woman coexist with times where we feel we're struggling. And her work is just so honest, and it's so funny. And it's, I think what her and a lot of the other, I guess you could say they're feminist artists doing is building a really strong bond between them and the other women. And I think they have such huge followings because they are the every woman. They're just representing how we feel and how we navigate.
And they show the other face that nobody wants to show, you know?
Yeah.
The weakness and stuff like that. And it really resonates with what you said at the beginning, that modesty is also about showing, you know, your weakness, your failures, that not everything is beautiful and perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, and in that way, it's kind of showing a new beauty, isn't it? Because it's, the thing that about bonds me with my female friends, especially, is when they are vulnerable in front of me and I can be vulnerable in front of them. That is what cements our friendship. And I really believe that relationships can't work fully if neither of you have ever been vulnerable in front of each other. Because if you're both just trying to be like, you know, yeah, everything's great, and I definitely, you know, if you never talk about your rejections from, you know, whether it be your love life or your professional life, how are you ever meant to connect with anybody? Because of course it's not comfortable to talk about at times, but I think it's essential to human relationships.
Because it's a part of life.
Exactly. Yeah. Go on.
No, I was like, so who else do you have to share with us?
So my last artist I want to talk about is, she's just, this project, honestly, is one of my favourite photography projects that's ever been done. So Clementine Schneiderman and Charlotte James. So Clementine's a photographer, and she collaborated with her friend Charlotte James on this, I guess it was like a community project where they went to the Sap Valley in Wales, a really small working class community, where they worked with children and teenagers, so young people, on creating their own couture fashion collection. And then they modelled them and they were photographed for this project. And when you look at the photographs, they're just so striking, because you've got these kids who have never seen a couture fashion gown in real life, probably don't have a huge amount of knowledge, are so far removed from, you know, the glamour of Paris Fashion Week, and yet they're in these gowns and they've got these furs and they're wearing like dusty purple and lime green, and they're posing like they're in a Vogue cover, and they're like, their backdrop is their working men's clubs or the rundown, you know, corner shop or their council estate. And it's just seeing that contrast, and it's this really witty, sweet comment on, I guess, class and the difference, and especially fashion within class, because fashion is a real status symbol, isn't it? It's status of your wealth, of your, you know, having good taste and good style is something that people are used to feel superior to others. And this photography project, and I think it's still ongoing in ways, it's called Fashion, but it's, the fashion is the Welsh spelling. So yeah, it's honestly one of the most beautiful. There's a book coming out as well.
You will have all the links?
Yes, I do. I'm going to send them all. I'm just so excited to talk.
I can't wait to receive it also, because when you speak, we want to see what it looks like.
You know, I know, I was really just thinking beautiful. That. I was like, we need an audio slideshow.
So I will put the link, and I hope that maybe people will be able to listen while they see the art.
I mean, yeah, I feel like I'm just such a big fan of that project. I think it's just, yeah, a real standout.
And do you have maybe an art or fashion, or maybe a few exhibitions that you went to and just left you speechless that you remember?
Oh, gosh, yes.
You have a lot.
I'll try and like narrow them down. I think my first one was, I think it was 2019? Yeah.
So 2 years ago.
2 years ago, it's the Simon Lee Gallery in London. So the Simon Lee Gallery is like one of my favourite galleries. It's a, it's in the West End of London. It's quite a small one, and they mostly just put on solo shows from different artists. But the curation and the experience is always amazing. And in particular, there's a Glaswegian artist called France Lise McGurns, who... her work is very simplistic and minimalist, like nude figures. And she does these figures like dancing together, and then she puts on just splatters of beautiful colour, and it's all very pastel and it's all very soft. So in the space, you just saw these canvases that were quite big and took up, but then the rest of the wall going onto the ceiling was also like a mural. So it's like the painting on the canvas continued and seeped into the walls. And it was just the most beautiful effect. And yeah, it was one of my favorite exhibitions that I've seen. I mean, it's so tough because I haven't barely, like in the last year, I haven't been to any because of lockdown, which is really sad.
That's so sad.
No, so it's kind of like, it's such a shame because those experiences have been taken from us. But yeah. And then as for fashion, I mean, fashion shows. Do you know the designer Ashes?
I don't think so. It's a French one or
they
British
are,
one?
I'm trying to find them. Ashes. So I think they're like, well, they're ready to wear en couture, but they just do the most beautiful fashion collections. And they, I mean, I don't know if I can get away with calling them modest. They're probably the opposite in terms of like, they're very avant-garde and flamboyant. And yeah.
And what's the name? It's Ashes on Instagram or the website?
Yeah, so it's Ashish.
Yes.
So they're based in London, but the Ashes Gupta is from Delhi.
Oh, okay, I see.
So he's an Indian designer. But do you know what I really recommend is the Dazed and Confused, which is a British magazine. They have a brilliant way of, they hire photographers to go backstage at the fashion shows, and they just get the most beautiful shots of backstage. And there's a show, I think, from 2017 from Ashes, which is really cool. And they have got these like big big wigs and all different colors, sparkles, sequins. It's pretty amazing.
So you'll send me all the links.
Yes, I will. I definitely will. Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting what you said about fashion shows, because sometimes I feel like backstage photos are more interesting than the photos of the fashion show itself.
Yeah, I completely agree. I just think, I felt like maybe the photographers can be more experimental and sorry, a little bit more daring and show a different side of things, because they're showing models preparing. They're not, you know, the models aren't they aren't in catwalk mode just yet. They're the one they're sort of all the crazy busyness of the backstage of a fashion show. So yeah.
And they also show the authenticity of all of that.
Yeah, and then, you know, the little glances between them, the little sort of selfies they take on their own iPhones, like they capture really good moments.
And now, as you are a writer, do you read also a lot?
Yes.
Okay, so no. I guess you have a lot of books recommendation to share with us.
Yes, I mean, in terms of the art scene, I think there's an author called Cassia Sinclair, and she's got two books at the moment. One's called The Secret Lives of Colour and the other's called The Golden Thread. So The Secret Lives of Colour is basically an encyclopedia of colour, and she puts them into sections of like pink, red, yellow, green, and then within that there's all the different types of pink, so fuchsia to I don't know, baby pink. And it's, she just talks about the origins and how pink, what pink, like originally, because apparently originally it was a colour for baby boys, which is very strange because
really
Yeah, what we know now is that when you have a baby girl, you dress her in pink, when you have a baby boy, you dress him in blue. So she just talks about like how the colours have evolved, and it's just a really beautiful book. And she does a very similar thing with her second book, The Golden Thread. So that's very much the same, but about materials. So, for example, silk, where how it's made and when it was originally used and how it was used to how it's being used today. And I think it's almost these books I kind of see as essential for, firstly, anyone interested in fashion history and fashion design, but also if you're just a writer in a way, because it's like a fast track to the history of that particular thing. They're really amazing books, and they're kind of something that you just keep on your bookshelves to dive into every now and again. Yeah, which are amazing.
That's interesting. I've never heard of her. I'll add the description. I also did a conversation with a woman. She told me about an author. I think it was a man that wrote about colors. Like, he had a book on the color red. So the whole book was speaking about just the color red and also how it's perceived and its signification. And I was surprised because I didn't know that we could say so much about a single color, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. God, I know. I've been writing a little bit at the moment about the color pink. And it's just fascinating. Also, just seeing how it's used as a tool of a symbolic tool in you know, film and costume design to the way that we decorate our houses. And yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, that's sort of the actual essence of what I love about art history, is finding out where this cultural signal for something actually came from and why it signals a certain thing. So why does pink signal femininity? I find that really interesting.
Yes, that's really interesting to know. I'll try to read those books because now you got me interested to learn more about about that.
Yeah.
So what would be your other recommendations if you have other books to share?
I think on the realms of art history, there is an art historian and writer called Alice Proctor. So she's Australian-British, I think, and she was doing uncomfortable art tours in London. So she would do tours of the big art institutes in London. So the V&A Museum, the British Museum, and would talk about the colonisation of the paintings and take you through to how, for example, someone like Henry Tate, how he's hoarded and he has two art galleries in London named after him. But he was very much involved in the slave trade. And of course, once you know that fact, it's incredibly uncomfortable. And she takes you through the different paintings and talks about the context and the subject matter of these paintings, but also talks about how it's been curated in the space and how the museum have chosen to display this work and how a lot of the time they are covering up things, you know, the caption on the wall and choosing to admit certain information because because it's about, you know, the slave trade and the colonization.
Very sad.
Yeah, but it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. She's amazing. And she's written a book called The Whole Picture, which is talking about different types of museums and galleries and how they have navigated the subject matter of colonialization. And of course, it's incredibly, incredibly prevalent to today, I think.
Yes.
Mm. It's just like amazing how she talks about it. And yeah, I think she's quite fearless because she really takes on these big institutions in a very quiet, polite way. Because when we go to the art tours, she's lovely, but she's got a really good relationship with all the staff at these museums and galleries. So, but yeah, she's going around. And
it's good because she brings the light on the subject that people don't really talk about or prefer to stay quiet about.
Mm. which I think hopefully, and far too late, but especially in the wake of Black Lives Matter, you know, there's been a real call for education and for resources to be used to for people to really take responsibility when it comes to anti-racism and looking into, you know, it's so complex and it's so ingrained, but there's a lot of work to do. And I think this is just, you know, one book to read where it's a real example of how big British institutions have taken artwork and displayed it in a way that isn't the full truth. And it's just, it's a truth that suits them. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. So you read a lot of books about art.
Well, actually, I mean, I just read a lot, basically. And that's not a brag. I mean, I don't sit and read like Chaucer and stuff. I'm just looking at my bookshelf now. I mean, there's a lot of authors, Ali Smith, Emma McBride. I'm actually reading a book at the moment, which is a debut novel by Rebecca Watson called Little Scratch. And they all write in this very poetic prose. It's a novel, but the way they write is very, it's not a linear sentence. They're sort of broken up and they tell the story through connection of words and rhymes. And when I first read, I remember first reading Annie McBride and the first page, I was like, nah, can't do this, and threw it to the side. And then I came back to it a couple of months later and I realised it was one of my favourite books ever. So I think I love writers that like that who tell stories, but in this, it's almost like a serial monologue. It's almost like words just spilling out of them, but they manage to really get to the depth of a feeling or of a moment.
Well, that's interesting. If you have other recommendation, you can still send them to me and I'll add them to the description. And I'll also, you know, I created kind of an Alma's library where I share all the book recommendations I get, because I have the feeling that when you read a new book, you expand to a whole new universe and a way of seeing life, you know, seeing the world. And it's a way to travel.
It is. I mean, I can't wait to see that library recommendations. And I think for me, reading is and I think it's the most important when you read stories from experiences that just are so far removed from your own. I think when you take into the responsibility of like learning about how other people have had to experience life and live their life, I think it's
really, it also helps to develop your empathy, to try to understand things that you would maybe not be able to understand because it's not your culture or you are not used to it. So,
and I think that's, yeah, it's like, but that's kind of art, isn't it? Because by using a human art form in writing novels or poetry, you are connecting to another human being, you're being able to relate to them about a subject that they may never have experienced, but yet because they're also a human and the writer is a human, they can connect in this way. And I think it's a really like beautiful.
Yes, and you know, I think, I don't know what you think, but writing is also a form of art.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, yes, 100%. I think, I mean, in a way, I feel like everything's art. I'm one of those like fairy fairy people. It's like interior design is art, shopping is art.
Thank you. I agree with you. To me, I also see that everything can be art.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I've got a real obsession with collections. I love, not that I'm a big collector myself, but I love it if someone has a big collection of something, whether it be like stamps or memorabilia from the 70s. And I sort of see that as an art form itself. So
really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, I have a stamps collection. Really? So maybe I'm an artist in some way by collecting stamps.
You absolutely are, in my eyes. How long has your art stamp collection been?
Well, I did that when I was young, you know, so maybe it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But unfortunately, now we... don't really send postcards as often as we used to. Yes. I don't have a lot of new stamps to add to the collection. But I think that's still good, because maybe in 20 years, we could say to our grandchildren, you know, when we were your age, we used to send postcards. You don't know what it is, but you used to put stamps on it. And that can be good, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I find them fascinating. And they, I don't know if you do also do this, but I know a lot of my friends do, and I also do it, is that I keep like a box of just stuff. So like letters, birthday cards, tickets to exhibitions, or I don't know, boarding passes. And I've just got them all in this box that I've just collected over the years. And when you look back at them, you know, as myself as a 13-year-old, I'm like, you find like a really funny note from a friend, and it's just really lovely, like, and really fascinating. So
yes, unfortunately I don't do this, but I guess that could be really interesting when you plunge into those memories and you're like, oh, I remember when I did that.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. And you know, in on a daily basis, how do you keep inspired and feed your creativity, like, every day?
Well, I mean, sort of by collection. So most of my collection is like, I put it on my laptop, so it's never that physical. But I am always keeping like an archive of images, whether it be from fashion shows or artworks, photography, sometimes even like advertisement campaigns I think are cool, like, and keeping them in one place. And then, for example, when I read books, I usually note down sentences or passages that I really like and just keep them in a document. And it's all just like funny things that my friends have said. I usually note that down and record it. And it's just keeping all this material here. And I think that is how I, it really inspires me to, I mean, sometimes you don't do anything with it. Sometimes I might do a bit of writing in response to it. But I think it's just like, yeah, keeping something for later, because you don't know how it's going to, it might help. And especially when I was curating full time, it was so handy just to always have that collection there, or having those archives there, because if you were doing a collection that was focused on mental wellness, you could dive into that imagery and those ideas, and you've got like a real gem that you've been saving for ages that you can come back to. And I think in literature and reading and books, and I've recently been reading poetry, which I never ever did, and I'm recently getting into it. So those have been my main sources, and just collecting like sentences and beautiful bits of writing from that.
That's interesting. And also about poetry, because I was speaking with someone and she told me that the future is in poetry.
Yes, that's amazing. Can you expand on that for me?
Well, she told me something that in this world where we all live in uncertainty, poetry is the fastest way to bring emotions to people, because it's short to read, but the amount of emotion that you can receive from a poem can be very, very extreme, I would say.
Mm. And I think, yeah, and I think with poetry, it's fearless and it's got no boundaries, because it just can do whatever it wants, and it's not bound by having to even tell a narrative, or it doesn't even have to be meaningful. Like, it can be whatever it wants. And I think that
it's also a form of art.
Oh yeah, I mean, anything you say. I think, yes. Honestly, my dad is a consultant engineer, and he really believes that engineering is art, and whenever he does try and explain it to me, I can really see what he means, because you're having to be creative, and you're having to like make things work and think in a way that you're dealing with physics and mass, but also creating something, and you're having
to be creative in your way of solving problems.
Yes, exactly. So engineering is also art.
Everything is art. Yeah. I'm good that we agree on that point, because some people, you know, sometimes when I was trying to having some feedbacks from people about modesty and art and fashion, they were like, to me, fashion is not a form of art. So not everyone thinks so, you know, but I think that even everything is art. I think this could be the final point.
Yes, everything is art. But it's so interesting when you say about, I guess, is it because they see fashion as such a business tool, which it is? I mean, it's a huge, it must be one of the largest contributors to the economy, like, with fashion. So I guess it's such a business. But then contemporary art, so the very traditional idea of art, fine art being, you know, a painting, that is also a huge business and makes a lot of money. And is it, like we were talking about the banana, it becomes about trade and value, and it becomes less and less about the object, less and less about the artwork, and more about the money it can make. But
you know, I just had another thing interesting in mind, is that usually people who tell me that fashion is not art is people who are maybe artists or studied art. And you studied art, but you agree that everything can be art. So it's really interesting, you know. And I wanted to know, when you studied, did people also think like you that anything can be art? Or you were like, maybe in your studies, your professors told you that art is that and it can't be that?
Well, because I studied at Goldsmiths, and Goldsmiths is kind of renowned for, first of all, they only specialise in contemporary art, and they're very conceptual, so they're very philosophical. And so a lot of our modules that we did, we could study film and we could study theatre. So one of my modules, I studied the works of Samuel Beckett. So no, I think it was more of a general feeling that there was many things that could be art, and especially because a lot of the fine art students could also study art history as a double degree, and their artworks were, you know, their artworks were bits of writing and performance and making films. It wasn't just the traditional painting, sculpture. So yeah, I think maybe that's actually where my belief that everything, like, that so much can be art comes from, is from that study.
And it's also maybe the French mentality, because I spoke with a woman that she studied both in France and in the UK, and she was like in France, people tend to put us into boxes, while in the UK, people want us to express our feelings regardless of what we may think, or the opinion we can have on what people think.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. And we spoke a lot. And if people want to learn more about what you do, your projects, where can they find you? How can they contact you?
I'm trying to put together more of a sturdier platform. But at the moment, Instagram, we can put my Instagram handle on, and that will have links to bits of writing I've done. And every Friday I upload just stories of artists that I love and like, and there'll be a lot more exciting news to come on it.
Yes, I hope so.
It's all boiling at the moment, but yeah.
Okay, so we'll put the link on your Instagram account. And thank you very much for this very interesting conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. We've had the best time. You can tell that I've been yearning to talk to someone.
And I learned a lot of new artists, fashion designers, and yeah, so that was really insightful. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Have a great day. Bye.
You too. Thanks. Bye.